It is a great pleasure to welcome all of you to this fully online version of Latticework. Normally, we do this event at the Yale Club of New York City each year. Unfortunately, we've still had to delay our in-person engagement, but we hope to be back next December in person. For now, I think this format is a terrific one to have some fascinating conversations with thought leaders in the business, some of the best investors in the world. And I am especially grateful that we have some of our MOI members leading these fireside chats. And Chris Goulakos, who I want to welcome here first, is someone who has given back to the community in this way. And I'm so grateful to you, Chris, because I know you have a great relationship and rapport with Howard Marks. And I know you've had some terrific discussions with Howard over the years. And so this is almost like having us be flies on the wall listening to one of your conversations. And I think all of us will get so much out of it. So thank you for doing this. Just by way of background, Chris is the founder and managing partner of Balius Partners, an alternative asset manager applying value investing principles in the digital economy. He's also board observer and investor or advisor at several companies, specializes in M&A capital allocation, capital markets policy. Prior to starting Balius Partners, Chris worked at MidOcean Partners, a $9 billion alternative asset manager in New York. He's also the co-chair of the Hellenic Initiatives New Leaders Group and a member of the Milken Institute Young Leaders Circle. He is a graduate of the Value Investing Program at the Ivy School of Business and lives in Washington, D.C. The theme of this year's Latticework is intelligent investing on the right side of change. And so in this session, Chris and Howard will explore the topic of tech disruption and what it means for value investing in the digital age. Chris, I would like to turn it to you to introduce Howard properly and get us started.
Thanks, Sean, and good morning, everyone. It's truly an honor to be opening this conference and especially the panel with Howard, an investor who needs no introduction to this community or any community for that matter. Howard, co-founder of Oaktree, legendary investor and author of the famous memos, which I'm sure we've all learned from and drawn inspiration from. So the idea behind this fireside came together a couple of weeks ago, and I was catching up with Howard in Los Angeles at another conference. And what we noticed and observed was that there was a very pronounced difference as far as the content and themes at that event, moving more so away from value towards growth and different topics around innovation, entrepreneurship, and disruption. And building on some of the latest memos that Howard put together, particularly something of value, we thought it could be fun to share that conversation with the community at large. But before we get into that, Howard, it's 5 a.m. on the West Coast, and we have the Fed's open market last meeting of the year this year. Is that keeping you up at night and wondering what your thoughts are on the market of late?
Well, Chris, first of all, I want to thank you for doing this with me. And you and I have been discussing these things for, I would say, 15 years. You may be able to correct me on that. And you have a great understanding of investing, and especially value, and of course you integrate it with your investment practice, which is based in technology. So I think you're the perfect person to lead this discussion. As for the Fed, first of all, I sleep like a baby, I don't believe in forecasts. So I don't have expectations for what the Fed's going to do. I mean, I have an opinion, but I don't bet my life on it. And whether they're going to do it or not going to do it doesn't keep me up. They'll do what they're going to do, and then we investors will. Well, then the economy react, the market will react, and we will react. But I don't. I guess as you know, One of my favorite sayings is from Einstein, I don't worry about the future, it'll come soon enough. And so I pretty much tend to focus in the present and not worry too much on the future.
So as far as the president and some of the events that have been moving the markets of late, we've seen a resurgence of Omicron. There's obviously geopolitical flashpoints with Russia, Ukraine, and NATO. Employment numbers, inflation numbers moving in interesting directions. How are you thinking about, 2022? You recently raised your largest fund. And, what should that signal as far as where we are in the cycle?
2022, obviously, there are several moving pieces. The main ones, which have been the moving pieces now for over a year, are the disease, our progress against it, versus the evolution of new variants, and how these things will affect primarily the economy, plus, of course, our daily lives. Then we'll worry about inflation. And I would imagine we're largely over with big giveaways of money. But you never know. The government has done a huge amount. They have been $4 to $5 to $6 billion of spending bills, depending on how you count them, to combat the voluntarily induced economic downturn. Obviously, they wanted to be very generous. They wanted to really kickstart the economy. I say that because roughly 20%, or I should say up to 20% of people were probably directly affected economically by the pandemic. Certainly in the later rounds, up to 80% of the population got checks. The government giveaways were not merely to make up for the economic consequences, but they went far beyond that. 2020, for that reason, 2020 was the best year in 20 years for disposable income. And we saw, it was estimated that there was still roughly $2 trillion of money piled up because A, the government gave out money, and B, most people couldn't spend it, because they couldn't go to stores, they couldn't go on vacations, they couldn't hold events, et cetera. So I would hope we're finished with that, because that $4, $5, $6 trillion of spending bills added to the liquidity injected by the Fed's bond buying and the Treasury's activities, has obviously contributed to inflation, which is running close to 7% and the highest we've seen in many years. I lived through the 70s. They were an unpleasant period because of inflation and its persistence and our uncertainty as how to fight it until Volcker came along and raised rates. And you have to raise rates higher than the rate of inflation to choke it off. He did. And he was a hero for that reason. And, if inflation stays high, they'll have to do that again. And that will probably bring on a recession as it did in the early 80s. So inflation is uncertain. The disease is uncertain. Geopolitics is always uncertain. I think the economy will continue to be good unless there's a massive shutdown again. And I doubt they're going to shut down massively again. Especially because the Omicron doesn't seem to be as serious in terms of a serious illness, hospitalization, and death. As I end most of my writing these days, there's only one thing I'm sure of: we'll see.
And so with we'll see, do you worry at all about a hard landing, a soft landing, and where are you looking for opportunities across this, this broader range of potential outcomes?
I would say as of now, we'll have a soft landing. If I'm, and by the way, we may not have a landing at all. If the Omicron is the dominant strain, and if it becomes the dominant strain, and if it is less serious in terms of hospitalizations and death, and if we don't have a full close, which I assume we won't, because I think the patients with it is less than it used to be, then I think that the growth will slow, but I don't think it's going to turn negative. Negative. When you talk about a landing, I think you're mostly talking about negative growth in the economy, and I don't think we're going to have a hard landing. But you know, it's one as you know well. And I'm going to fill this hour with my sayings, one of which is that it's one thing to have an opinion. We all have opinions, but it's something very different to believe it's right and act on it strongly. And at Oaktree, one of the six tenets of our investment philosophy is that our investment decisions are not driven by macro forecasts. And so no matter what I think about the landing, we're unlikely to do much about it in investment portfolios. Having said that, you mentioned our fund. We had the final close for our fund a month or so ago, so I can talk about it. It's $15.9 billion. It's our largest fund ever. These funds used to be called stress debt funds. We've broadened our charter to the effect that we'll do anything that we consider opportunistic. That we now call them global opportunities funds. Roughly 70% of that $15 billion is invested so far. The fund is just about a year and a half old, and we'll continue to invest. We hope, from our standpoint, that we will get to finance some companies that made it through the pandemic thus far, through bailouts and through the capital markets' unstoppable demand for paper, which made large sums of money available and reduced the likelihood of default. So, you know, we imagine that if we have a slowing of the economy and a cessation of government check writing, that we will get some more companies that are in need of financing, you might call it rescue financing, and that we'll have more to do quantitatively, and it'll be better in terms of quality and, in particular, expected return. But that's just a hope.
And maybe on that, so the pace of investment, so you mentioned 70% deployed, so $10 billion in a year. John, if you want to pull that chart up for a second, one thing that is getting a lot of conversation in my world is just the pace of deal flow. If you look here, we have seen literally a 2-standard deviation jump as far as the pace of private equity exits. I'm wondering if that signals anything to you or reminds you of past periods or past cycles.
I don't think we've ever had money spent at this pace. Obviously, the chart shows that we have it in the last 20 years. People spent frenetically in the 80s, but in much smaller deals. You know, in those days, a $1 billion deal was considered huge. I think, you know, that what you see is really the result of the fact that stocks did so badly in 2001 and two with the bursting of the tech bubble and a serious recession and the downgrade of telecoms and the Enron scandal, et cetera. It was the first 3-year decline for the S&P since the days of the Great Depression. And a lot of people got turned off to stocks. They said, we need an alternative. Maybe that's where the term alternative investing came from. So a lot of people turned in 03, 04 to hedge funds. Hedge funds that used to be 100 million became a few billion. In my opinion, that onrush of capital and the changed behavior it brought really signaled the end of hedge funds as a big thing. And of course, you know, there are still many hedge funds, and there's still lots, there's trillions in hedge funds, but nobody talks about hedge funds anymore. They're not the magic that they were 20 years ago. So if you need alternatives and you can't count on hedge funds to give you high returns, then what's the next best candidate? And it seems to be private equity. Private equity is probably the biggest alternative asset class. It has been around the longest. It really started, I think, KKR, Apax, and one or two others started doing what we would call buyouts on leverage, you know, using other people's money to buy companies or parts thereof. I believe that started around 74 with KKR, as I recall. So it's been around almost 50 years, which is interesting. Of course, not a household word necessarily. And by the way, a different word. I want to point out, if you, for those of us who study markets and behavior of members of markets, that this there was no such term as private equity in the 80s. Or the 70s, it was called leverage buyouts. And we used to talk about LBOs all the time. You don't see LBOs in the press anymore. I think the main reason for that is they did so horribly. The leverage buyouts in the 80s in particular, you know, brought in some large companies, Federated Department Stores, Macy's, Campo up at Canada, National Gypsum, U.S. Gypsum. These were roughly billion-dollar companies, and as I say, that was considered a lot of money in the 80s. I think all the ones I named went bankrupt. RJR Nabisco, which was a $27 billion. Just think of that—a $27 billion transaction in a time of billion-dollar transactions, almost went under. Never did. But it came close and scared the heck out of a lot of people, probably including the owners over at KKR. So they had to change the name. And in the 90s, they invented the name private equity. And as I say, you don't hear LBO anymore, which used to be ubiquitous. And then the great thing about the private equity business is they can create their own deal flow. If you're an opportunistic lender, or a distressed debt investor like us, you really can't create deal flow in that you can only lend money to the companies that default or the companies that are in bankruptcy or the companies that are in extremis. The private equity industry can create its own deal flow because they can go to any company in the world and try to buy it. They're doing much larger quantity. They're getting much larger quantities of money now. I remember, wasn't it in 06 that we, in 05, I think we started seeing $5 billion buyout funds. And in 06, I think it was September, or maybe it could have been September 05, I wrote a memo called The New Paradigm. They're investing large quantities of money and they'll keep doing so.
So in what ways is the disruption and the accelerated pace of technological innovation accelerated the pace of disruption and the opportunity set for you? Are you seeing incumbents struggling and requiring incremental capital, or is it risks that you're not prepared to assume given technology? How do you incorporate that into your process?
Yeah. Well, first of all, I mean, there are a lot of answers. I wish I had a paper so I could take notes and fully answer your question. First of all, we're not tech investors. And, one of the conclusions from my discussions during lockdown with my son, who lived with us for 3 years with his family, 3 months, 3 years, maybe is what it felt like. But, we lived together for 3 months. We discussed tech growth and crypto ad nauseum. I think that in a way, tech is harder now in the sense that you have to know more about it. You have to have more subject matter expertise. We had the tech began to be an important part of investing in the 60s. In those days, we called it growth investing. Of course, there were other aspects to growth than just tech. But tech meaning Xerox, IBM, Hewlett-Packard, Perkin-Elmer, Texas Instruments, those companies were part of the Nifty 50, which got its start back in the 60s. I studied Xerox in those days, and I felt that I knew enough to do so. Today, I think you have to have more technological expertise to know which companies will succeed, which will fail, and which will thrive. So that's a change. Number two, obviously, we used to talk about companies that were either stable or defensible, consumer staples, and we used to talk about moats. And I think it was Warren Buffett who invented the word moat, maybe wrong. But, in my book, second book, the Mastering the Market Cycle, I talk about the newspaper industry. It was the perfect thing to invest in. It had the world's greatest moats. If you had the newspaper in your town, you owned it. You didn't worry about competition from the newspaper in the next town because you gave the want ads and the used car ads for your town, maybe legal notices and stuff like that. And the person in the next town did the used car ads and the notices for that town. And there wasn't much crossover because why would somebody in that town advertise in your paper and vice versa? The other thing is that everybody bought the paper. My dad used to read two papers a day, one on the commute to work, one on the commute back. The paper was a dime. That didn't strike us as a lot of money at the time. Certainly it's pennies today, literally. The great thing about the newspaper from the point of view of the publisher is that if you buy it today, you have to buy it again tomorrow. There's no shelf life. It doesn't continue to be relevant. So, and of course, there was no worry about national TV, which was national and didn't handle the local. So there were lots of reasons why a newspaper had great moats. And Warren invested extensively in newspapers. He's famous for his investment in the Washington Post, but he did a lot of other papers. And today, most of the newspapers are fighting for their lives. And if it wasn't for the fact that the political arena has turned into, some cross between national emergency and an entertainment arena, then I think many more newspapers would be out of business. So we don't invest much in technology. We once did a tech investment back about 20 years ago in the distressed debt funds. We found the distressed tech company and we literally got our heads handed to us because of the ephemeral nature of the value of tech, especially if you don't feed it with money to keep developing it. And by the way, it was a steady mantra 20 or 30 or 40 years ago that you don't put leverage on tech companies because the underlying businesses are unstable. And if you lever them up, then they really become very volatile. Obviously, in the search for investment opportunities, the buyout industry has gotten away from that rule. What's my answer, Chris? We'll see.
So, specialized tech private equity funds, Silver Lake, Thoma Bravo, Vista, what they have brought, to the private equity space as far as tech investing is this idea that the SaaS contracts are almost as good as any contracted revenue stream, which lends themselves, albeit asset light, to balance sheet leverage. Is that something that you see as an opportunity or is that something you'll stay away from the perspective of the creditor? And you think it's somewhat imprudent that venture debt is being raised at such a high pace?
On the one hand, there's nothing wrong with lending against a money good long-term contract. And to give you an extreme example, if you go back long enough is probably sometime in the 90s, I think it was the 90s, could have been the 80s. But the most popular TV show was called Dallas, and Larry Hagman and all these other people. It was really an evening soap opera. It was enormously popular. And, you know, I learned about the TV model that you make a show, you get a contract to put it on the air. You may make or lose a little money in the first season. Maybe the contract proceeds pay your costs of making the episodes. But then if you can get into syndication and you can sell the episodes to somebody for showing over, then you can really clean up. And Dallas was sold into syndication with some, I think it was CBS, with some extremely strong contracts. And I gave Lorimar, which was the company that made Dallas, a loan against those contracts. So it doesn't have to be hard assets. There's nothing wrong with a solid long-term contract if it's solid and long-term. Now, it may take software expertise to assess the longevity of those contracts and the renewability of those contracts, but I don't rule it out per se.
Great. You mentioned your book, Mastering the Market Odds, and you know, you use a lot of analogies from betting, be it backgammon, be it poker, be it blackjack. And, you know, in situations like that, there's a pit boss, there's a dealer, you know how many cards there are on the deck, you know how many dice there are and the permutations.
Yeah.
So you could, to a certain extent, handicap the risk. Yeah. In today's world where the Fed is more active, government is involving themselves in markets, and innovation continues to change the structure of the system, how can you properly handicap? How can you define the margin of safety? And how do you invest in a changing landscape?
Right. Well, that's a great question. And as John said in the introduction, you think a lot about change, and the result is a question like that, which is a damn good question. I will say before I answer that you were extolling the virtues of gambling and how fair it is, because the odds on the dice are known. There's a pit boss who keeps the game honest. The games, they're regulated, which our industry isn't regulated as much as the Las Vegas casino industry, et cetera. So there are lots of, shall we say, good things about gambling. And as you know, I enjoy gambling. I'm great at playing blackjack for 10 bucks a hand. You know, that's different in our industry. But if you look at the gambling industry with all the protections of the, let's call them investor protections, still most of the people leave all their money at the casino. So I don't think that financially gambling is a good model for us, because we hope not to leave our money at the casino. We'd like to end up with some at the end of the year, and hopefully more than we started. You're right. The tech aspects of the investment industry are less regulated. The odds on a pair of dice are absolutely known. You know, you say, well, there are 36 possible combinations of two six-sided dice. And you know, for example, that six of them will result in the number 7. 1, 6, 2, 5. 3, 4, 4, 3, 5, 2, 6, 1. You know, 6 out of 36, or 17%, will give you the number 6. Of course, it's really important to bear in mind that even when you know the probability distribution, as you do to perfection with dice, you still don't know what's going to happen. The probability distribution with technology, software, and so forth isn't even known in advance. Some people know it better than others. That's the key. And if you know more about the subject than other people do, you can invest in it intelligently, maybe even with something approaching safety, but only if your knowledge is superior. And that's, people have to realize in investing, and I know you and I have talked about this ad nauseum, and I write about it ad nauseum, that success in investing, which I define as superior results. You know, investing is this weird field where it's really easy to be average and it's really hard to be above average. But being above average is my definition of success in investing. Success in investing does not come, or superior performance does not come from being right about the future. It comes from being more right than others. In other words, if you think GDP is going to grow at 2%, And it does grow at 2%. If everybody thinks it's going to grow 2% when you do, your 2% forecast is not a valuable forecast. The only valuable forecasts are non-consensus correct forecasts. It's very hard to make a non-consensus forecast because usually, for example, extrapolation is correct and most people do it. And then having made a non-consensus forecast, it's hard for it to be right because extrapolation and consensus forecasts are right most of the time. But it is the non-consensus correct forecasts that make the holder a lot of money. It all goes to making better judgments. I wrote a memo, maybe it was September of 15, it was, what it said is that I think it was entitled Not Easy. When I was putting the finishing touches on my first book, the most important thing, I was discussing with Charlie Munger, whose office is in the building next to mine in downtown LA. And we talked about it at length. And as you can imagine, incredibly enjoyably. And when I got up to go, Charlie said, remember, none of this is meant to be easy. And anybody who thinks it's stupid, thinks it's easy is stupid. And it is. It can't be easy. Everybody wants to make money. The money will go to the people who do a superior job, not to everyone. And what's the definition of superior job? In my opinion, making superior judgments. So the question is, do you know enough about technology to make a superior? You were probably wondering where I was going with this meandering answer. But you should ask yourself before making a tech investment or any investment, might I know more about this than most others? Am I more likely to be correct in my judgments of the future than most others? And if you're not, then there's no reason to expect that it will bring you the best superior investment results. You mentioned funds that do venture lending. If they have an edge in assessing the technologies on which they're putting their bets, they could win consistently. We know that in Silicon Valley, there are firms that win consistently. Now, some of that is because of superior knowledge. I would imagine some of it is because, as the acknowledged winners, there's a self-fulfilling aspect to their success, because that means that more young companies come to them to get financing, because they know that, number one, a financing from company X, fund XYZ, will give them the seal of approval. And number two, the folks at XYZ can probably give them some help. The average venture fund, the average buyout fund, their performance is no great shakes. It all comes from being above average. And one of the greatest questions for investors who look at these funds is their persistence in their success. But certainly in venture, there seems to be, because there are a few firms that are better situated than the rest.
Great. And in today's economy, it's all about FANG buzzwords like network effects, platform businesses. You talk about the Nifty 50 and how that shaped a lot of your thinking and your career trajectory. How do you contrast the quality of the business today relative to the Nifty 50? And what were the buzzwords that seduced investors back then? And should we be cognizant of any of that as we look at these businesses?
We always have to be on alert as investors for, look, you make the most money in assets that have merits that have not been discovered. You lose the most money in investments that have merits that have been overstated, or demerits, faults that others have not figured out. And that was, that truth is is eternal. So back in the 60s, which is when I came into the industry, and I remember sitting in my family's apartment, probably around 64-ish, reading the first brochure on growth investing. I think it came from T. Rowe Price. And that was when the Nifty 50 was flying. And the Nifty 50 did phenomenally in the 60s. The buzzwords basically were that these were companies where nothing bad could happen. And because nothing bad could happen, and because they grew faster than the average company, there was no price too high. And there was literally no concern with valuation because people said, well, you know, these companies are growing so fast that if you buy them and the price turns out to be a little high for today, wait a couple of years that the asset, the earnings will grow and it'll be priced fairly then. But, you know, if you bought those stocks the day I came to work full-time at Citibank in 1969 after grad school, and if you held those stocks firmly for 5 years, the greatest companies in America, you lost almost all your money. First of all, a lot of the companies that were expected, that where people said, well, you know, that nothing bad can happen, either faltered or just disappeared. And my favorite whipping, I don't know if you can say whipping boy anymore. That sounds very sexist. Whipping person in those days was something called a simplicity pattern. They sold patterns can you say women, to people who made their own dresses. You know, who do you know today that makes their own clothes anymore? Everybody had a sewing machine in those days. Nobody does today. So obviously things can happen. A much more simplistic, Xerox had a lock on the dry copying business. You know, XER is from the Greek for dry. Before that, all copying was wet. You would take your document down to a shop. You'd have to walk several blocks if you lived in the big city. And they would make a photostat through a photographic process involving chemicals, and you'd have to come back for it. And Xerox created the first dry copying machine, and they had a lock on that industry, and I followed it as an analyst. And basically what they did is the machines were so big and they priced copying very high, and that brought in competition from abroad with small machines and low prices. And Xerox, I forget if they went bankrupt or almost went bankrupt. So number one, a lot of the companies where nothing bad could happen, things went bad. And that shows you the limitations of investors' foresight. And number two, they were just priced too damn high. And the PE ratios on those stocks ranged up to 80 and 90. And 5 years later, they were selling at PE ratios in single digits. That's a good way to lose most of your money. You know, if nothing else changes, you'll lose 90% of your money. If the multiple goes from 80 to 8, that's what we call higher math. You know, look, whenever merits are overestimated, the scene is set for investors to lose money. And it happened then, and it happened in 1999, 2000 with that TMT bubble. And it happened with housing in 2006-07. And I would imagine that some of the tech companies today that are attracting investors' attention and attracting loans from the credit community, I would say for the first time, you know, some of those will turn out to have been overestimated. And one of the things that happens in, we could say, bubbles or what, you know, in times of popularity, is that investors discover an industry that they hold in high esteem, and they act and invest as if every company in the industry will be successful, or maybe I should say has a chance at being successful. And you know, you find a company that it's selling for $1 billion, and you say, well, that's an awful lot for a company that doesn't have any sales or revenues or profits. And the people say, well, yes, but it has a 5% chance of being worth $100 billion. So it has a $5 billion expected value. It's only selling for a billion. You could make 5x. And so it's justified on the basis of a low probability of a huge outcome. And we call that lottery mentality. But that's what takes over in bubbles, especially in new fields. And most bubbles occur in new fields because the newness of the subject matter is A, seductive, and B, since it's new, there are no precedents to limit investors' imagination.
Great, and maybe the last one, John, before we open it up to Q&A. So you wrote a great memo, Something of Value, where you really highlight the evolution of your thinking. So we think back, you know, the past year, 2 years of living under COVID, what bad ideas have you discarded as far as investing, and what new mindsets, frameworks, and mental models have you adopted?
Well, thank you, Chris. That's very diplomatically put, you know, in other words, what were my big mistakes? I think one of the things that Andrew pointed out when we were living together is how the markets have changed in the following sense. We all know as growth investors, we've all heard Warren Buffett talk about buying dollars for 50 cents. And if you go back 50, 60, 70 years ago when he was doing it, I would say it's fair to say the world was a stupid place. And most people didn't know anything. They didn't know how to make money. They didn't know where to look for good investments. And because they didn't have computers and they were not interconnected and they didn't have easy access to data, it was kind of hard to find the companies whose $1 value securities were selling for 50 cents. Buffett did it, as I said in the memo, because you could imagine him sitting in the back room in Omaha and leafing through Moody's manual to find these bargains that were really lying there in plain sight if you only looked and did the hard work. One of the things Andrew pointed out maybe the most fervor was that today, unlike those days, you can't expect to make money just on the basis of readily available quantitative information regarding current activity. Why not? Because unlike the conditions I described in Buffett's days of 50, 60, 70 years ago, that information, everybody has it. Everybody has a computer. Everybody can get all the information they want. By the way, Andrew made the great observation that in my youth, if you wanted to study a company, you had to write a letter. I don't know if L-E-T-T-E-R, I don't know if the listeners remember that concept. You had to write a letter to the company, which would take a week to get there, asking for the annual report. And they may put you at the back of the line, and 2 weeks later they get to your letter and they send you out the annual report in the mail. So maybe it takes a month to get the annual report of a company you want to follow. And in the interim, there's not much you can find. There's no Google, there's no information online, et cetera. So the search for information was much more challenging. And some people would get this quantitative information regarding current activities, and others couldn't get it or didn't have the patience or wouldn't go to the trouble. So it wasn't that readily available. Today, everybody has it. And if Chris, I know that if you want to do a screen, you want to find a company of this size and this growth and this the PE ratio, you can find them all in 5 minutes or 2 minutes. When I say 5 minutes, I'm probably dating myself. So 10
seconds on Bloomberg.
Right, exactly. So the world's a very different place. And what that means is simply, you should not expect to be able to beat the market on the basis of readily available quantitative information on current activities. You have to either go for information which is not available, like the distribution of sales for a company, or which is about the future, not the present, which is not reported by the companies, but a matter of conjecture regarding the future. And clearly the profits from thinking about future results are going to come to the people who know that subject better. So it all, like I said, in Not Easy, it always comes down, in my opinion, to people who have superior subjective judgment.
Great. Well, hopefully this has helped us refine some more models. John, are there any questions in the audience?
Well, Chris and Howard, thank you so much. What a fascinating conversation between the two of you. Just a reminder to everyone listening in, and I see we have more than 100 live participants here. If you do have a question, feel free to type it in, and I will read it out if we have time. Before we get into the Q&A, Chris, I know you had three other graphs that you had prepared. Did you want me to show those now, or was I asleep?
Yeah, I guess while we're waiting on questions, this goes back to where we are in the cycle. There was an article in a journal on December the 9th entitled Elon Musk and Other Leaders Sell Stock at Historic Levels as Markets Soar. And Howard, again, you know, you can't predict the future, but you look at what other people are doing as a signal to what and where we could be in the cycle. When you see, you know, charts like this, what does that tell you as far as insiders selling out at a record pace?
I think a lot about this kinds of statement, because they always say, well, the inflation is as high as it's been in 20 years. The stock market, well, leave that inflation for a minute, but the prices are the highest they've ever been in 20 years. The stock market is made the biggest move since October, whatever it might be. A lot of these comparisons are not significant. When I look at the graph you showed, which shows the steadily increasing number of insiders selling large amounts of stock, one thing you have to ask yourself is, there you go. Okay, so it looks like it was 30 insiders back in 19, and it was 60 insiders in 2020, 65. So the question is simple. Did the value of stocks double? And if the value of stocks doubled, then you would think that the number of sellers of a certain amount of stock would double. That doesn't tell you anything. And the number went from 65 in 20 to 90 in 21. Did stocks go up a half? And lots of stocks did go up a half. Certainly not a lot of tech stocks went up a half. So the mere fact that more people are selling doesn't tell me that much. We know the market's way up. We know that a lot of people want to take some money off the table. And, for an entrepreneur who has his whole net worth and more in one stock, it's totally reasonable to sell some as they rise. And, I wrote in that memo something of value about my time with Andrew, that Andrew is not by nature a seller. You know, a lot of people sell because they want to take profits. They want to lock profits up. They're afraid otherwise they'll go away. He doesn't have that nerve in his body. So he's not a seller, but look, that's because he's just a money manager for our family and for his VC clients. But if you have all your net worth in one company, it's perfectly understandable to sell some.
Okay, let me take a question that's come in on your process. How has disruption changed your credit analysis process?
The main effect is that you have to think about disruption. You can't think of it, you can't look at a company and say, well, that's a stable consumer company like a newspaper, so it's probably free from the threat of disruption. Almost everything can be disrupted today in your industry by people who do it better and use tech better, and in terms of competition from outside your industry, as we've seen with the newspapers. So I would dare say that 50 years ago, when you looked at the Nifty 50, probably nobody had on their list, A, can this industry go out of existence, as it did with Simplicity Patterns? B, can our industry be competed or disrupted by people from other industries and other technologies and other means of doing business. Is technology going to be a big factor in our industry, and who's going to have the best tech? So, for example, in the Nifty 50s, in addition to Simplicity Pattern, we had, maybe Avon or Sears. How about Sears? Sears never thought that they would be disrupted by companies with that didn't even have stores or printed catalogs. We all have to think more about the likely longevity of our industries, companies, technologies, and so forth. You have to be adult enough to say, look, the technology could be really important in this industry. I'm not that good on tech, so I'm going to pass. Warren and Charlie talk about putting this or that on the too hard pile. And there's a lot in this world today which is too hard, much more today than there was 50 years ago. It's a funny thing, but I don't remember, well, maybe with the exception of Hewlett and Perkin and TI, which were in the Nifty 50, there were basically very few companies or industries where you would say, you know what, I don't understand that industry. I don't understand that product. I don't think I can invest in it because it's beyond me. Today, there's lots of things on the too hard pile for most of us. And, I would not like to invest in a tech industry doing battle with a bunch of people who know much more about a technology than I do. We have to include the question of disruption in our credit scoring, and we have to refuse to participate when it's above us.
Well, that's a really profound statement, Howard. I think that even though information is everywhere and there's more information than ever, there's also more things on the too hard pile than ever. That's quite interesting.
Oh, you have to understand, John. And so everybody now has a million times more information than we had 50 years ago. And everybody has it. But number one, superior investing comes from a superior access to information or a superior analysis of information. Information is not knowledge. Information is the raw material for knowledge. It's possible to have so much information that you have less knowledge than you used to because it's distracting and confusing. But, the mere fact, my favorite commercial, when was it? 20 years ago? I forget which bubble it burst in. But there used to be a commercial from an online brokerage firm. And it just said, if you want to make money, just sign up for our brokerage firm and get our data. And if you have an idea, and they show the person doing three keystrokes, and they say, just analyze it. How do you do that? And the implication is that by looking at a screen, the average person can figure out whether a stock's going to go up or down. And this is so crazy. And you just can't get away from the fact that in order to make more, you have to know more. And I never said that before, but you may see that in a memo. To think that you can produce superior profits without superior expertise and superior judgment just seems nutty.
Well, we are almost out of time. Perhaps we can leave everyone with a book that you found valuable to you or enjoyable to read that folks can pick up over the holidays here.
Well, Chris mentioned my tendency to compare investing with gambling because of the presence of randomness and unknown information and wide variety of possible outcomes. So there was a book that I read and discussed at the beginning of 20 called, I wrote a memo called You Bet, based on a book by Annie Duke, Thinking in Bets. And the first part of that book, you know, in latter parts, it gets into other kinds of decision-making. But the first part of that book I thought was very valuable for investors. And then I must confess, I have to show my human weakness. My favorite book of 2021 was something called Caesar's Palace Coup, about the buyout of Caesar Palace and the ensuing legal machinations, because normally in a bankruptcy, the old owners are wiped out and the old creditors become the new owners. The owner of Caesar's Palace did not want to see its equity wiped out. And so they took steps to avoid that process. And since we were among the creditors, a couple of the creditors decided to fight them. And the book is about the battle. And it shouldn't surprise you to find out that Oaktree and Appaloosa, David Tepper's Appaloosa, were the big winners in Caesar's Palace restructuring, and that the equity owners were the big losers. I'll read any book in which we're the winners. But a lot of people have told me that it was a great book. It's quite technical when you get through the machinations of the transactions they engaged in to try to preserve their equity. But it's a fun outcome as far as I was concerned.
Well, first you got to get to the point where there are books about you being a winner. I'm still working on that one. Chris and Howard, thank you so much for such a wonderful conversation. I feel truly privileged to have been a part of it.
Thank you, John. I want to say one last thing about the book before I say goodbye. What makes me happy is not merely the fact that we won, but I think it's clear from the book that Oaktree in particular, and I think Appaloosa, engaged in the most ethical possible way. And our fight, which won us a lot of money, was really based on solid principle. And it was really just the triumph of right. And I'm very proud of my Oaktree colleagues. You know, I didn't do the heavy lifting on Caesars, but people like Ken Lang and Kaiva Salas did. And it's a great outcome in a great way. And I think that whatever we do in our professional lives, even our personal lives, it's the only thing that matters is not what the outcome was, but how it was achieved. And I'm very proud of being able to achieve great outcomes on the high road. It was a pleasure to be here again, John. I've done a number of your conferences, as you noted, and it's always fun to be among friends. And I want to thank Chris for his good questioning. And, you know, Chris worked very hard on this, and together we refined the questions, and I hope it was good for you, John, and for your members.
Likewise, thank you very much.
Pleasure.
Thank you so much all for participating. And in just a few minutes, join us for our next live session. That will be with Scott Miller at Greenhaven Road Capital and Savneet Singh, CEO of PAR Technologies. Talk to you soon.